From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson on her latest book, Be Fierce, then a conversation about the impact of student debt on degree completion rates as part of our ongoing education series with Douglas Haynes, Vice Provost of the University of California, Irvine, John King Jr., President of the Education Trust, and Michelle Siquieros, President of the Campaign for College Opportunity. And star of The Walking Dead, Danai Gurria, talks about the hit show's eighth season. But first, President Trump's immigration policy has targeted groups that he has described as being a threat to American economic and national security. And his approach has won him many supporters. Journalist Sasha Polakow-Saransky has analyzed the growth of populist rhetoric in Western nations like the U.S. He shares his findings in a new book called Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. He also wrote a provocative op-ed titled White Nationalism is Destroying the West. I read that in the Times when it came out. What kind of backlash did you get to that?
I got some pretty creepy messages, Tavis. Some things I didn't want to see on Twitter and Facebook, but I suppose that comes with the territory. It's a controversial subject, and it got under a lot of people's skin.
Give me some sense of what you heard.
There was a lot of anti-Semitic backlash from white nationalist groups. I got a lot of comments looking into my own background and insinuating things about Jewish people. It was uncomfortable, but I wasn't entirely surprised. I think that there's some people out there who were offended by it because I was trying to call them out.
Yeah. Is immigration like, I'm going to say the new third rail, although there's nothing new about the debate, but is it a new third rail in politics?
I think it's become the central issue in this country and all throughout Europe. Yeah. Most of the reporting I did for this book was in places like France and Germany, Holland and Denmark. In fact, the book started as a project about European countries, and I was following around people like Marine Le Pen, anticipating that she might win the election. I didn't see Trump's victory coming. In retrospect, I probably should have, given that I was living in the UK as the Brexit vote approached, and I was hanging out with National Front supporters and leaders in France and this new AfD party in Germany that just won 13% of the vote. And so I ended up writing a little bit about my own country in the end, given what's happened here. But I do think that in all of these places, it has become the central issue. In Europe, part of that is because so many refugees came in, and a lot of people were understandably shaken and upset. That's a lot of people for any country to absorb in 1 year. So I understand the grievances of a lot of these voters, but what we've seen happen in all of these countries is opportunistic politicians take advantage of that anger and those grievances and push their own political agenda for their own advantage.
You draw a bold line and make a brash argument for this link between, as your subtitle suggests, the backlash against immigration and the fate of Western democracy. Again, I'm going to ask you to answer this in a question when you spend a whole book trying to address this.
Sure, I understand.
But that's a pretty strong link to draw, that the fate of Western democracy, the future of Western democracy, is linked somehow to this backlash against immigration. Give me your short thesis.
What I'm arguing is that the people who are leading the backlash against immigration right now, if they become increasingly popular, and if that becomes the central issue in election campaigns in all of these countries in the years going forward, they have the ability to draw large majorities into their orbit and win elections. And so part of that argument is, you know, everyone's afraid of terrorist attacks, everyone's afraid of immigrants, and a lot of the right's political program has been playing on those fears. But what I'm saying is that terrorist attacks are terrible and they're a real risk, and we as Western democracies need to deal with that and stop that, but it's manageable. We survived 9/11, the Brits survived the terrorist attacks there, the French have persevered. But if a party or a politician who is promoting an anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner, anti-refugee agenda brings enough people with them, and that becomes the central theme in the campaign, they can start to take things apart from inside. They can start to challenge the independence of the courts. They can start to take away birthright citizenship, which has been a big issue in a lot of these countries, and create a second class of citizens. So what I'm saying is that this isn't necessarily going to happen tomorrow, but this is a worrying trend that we see because people are voting for these sorts of politicians, and they're able to appeal, as I said in the New York Times op-ed, they're able to appeal to voters in a way that a radical Islamist never could. You know, no one's going to vote for an Osama bin Laden character if he were running in this country or in France, but someone can come up and say, we are the natives, this is our country, this is for us, and we don't want anyone else in it. And people are going to listen and they're going to vote. And that is what scares me. I feel that these people are able to get enough support and enough popularity to the point that they could actually dismantle some of the institutions that make our societies democratic.
By your own argument, though, Sasha, what that means is what you're doing is giving a lot of credence to the notion of fear. Mm. If we agreed in this conversation earlier, and I think we did, that this is motivated by fear.
It is.
You're giving fear a lot of power.
I think fear is very powerful.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but if you look at what has driven these elections in all of these places, it has been politicians who play upon that fear. And I have to give them credit too, because they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They are tapping into people's resentments and their fears, and they're getting votes. And I think that what people miss sometimes, see, it's fine for people to have reservations about immigration. I understand why people who see their whole neighborhood change in the matter of a few years, they might be upset, they might resent it, they might resent their politicians for not addressing it. That's fine, and that's a debate that we should be having. The problem is that some of these politicians, they don't have a democratic agenda. They aren't necessarily trying to preserve constitutional democracies, an independent judiciary, equal rights for all groups of citizens, access to social benefits for immigrant groups. They actually want it to be a state for the natives. It's a nativist agenda, and that is what scares me.
I take that. I want to push back on one thing.
Sure.
And I'm pushing back to make sure I understood what you meant by it. When you say that you understand, you know, when communities change and people have certain responses to that, and your phrase was, that's a debate we ought to be having. I'm not sure I agree with you. Why should that be a debate? If you live in a neighborhood and people of color move in, if you live in a neighborhood and everybody that looks like you no longer, you know, why do we have to have that debate?
What I'm saying is that a lot of politicians in
somebody black moves next door, somebody black moves on the street, now we gotta have a debate about it? I mean, why do we have to do that?
Yeah. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm saying is that a lot of politicians have not been able to recognize those grievances. So it's not to say, like, it's legitimate for you to move out because a group of black families or Mexican families moved in, or in Germany it's a group of Turkish families. People need to adjust, but what's happened in these countries is a lot of the politicians for so long in these countries, people in these neighborhoods were saying, hey, you know, we want to talk about this. There's some issues here. People aren't necessarily integrating. It's changing. And these are issues that should be talked about in terms of integration in European countries. And I think what happened is that they ceded that ground to these far-right parties.
I guess what I'm pushing back on, Sasha, I hear your argument. What I'm pushing back on, though, is why we label it a grievance. Mm. If people are in the country legally and they have a right to live and move and have their being, I don't know why, other than the fact that you want people in the neighborhood to look just like you, why that gets labeled a grievance and why we ought to have a debate about that.
Well, that's not legitimate. I agree with you there. What I'm saying is that, especially in these European countries that are different from the U.S. in the sense that they have comprehensive welfare states, right?
If you're
in a place like France, you have childcare from a young age, you have good health care paid for by the state for the most part. Places like Denmark, it's a cradle-to-grave welfare state, and people who've lived in those countries for so long become resentful that they are paying taxes for people who have come in as refugees. Now, I think these countries should be accepting people as refugees.
Right.
My own grandparents were refugees who left Berlin in the mid-1930s and went to South Africa, which is a country that at that time was not very welcoming to Jewish people. And so I understand these refugees should be coming in there, but these populations are reacting to it and they're saying, hey, we want to talk about this. We want to say, okay, maybe it shouldn't be everyone coming in, maybe not a million people in 1 year. And if the politicians don't sit down and listen to them and have that debate, that's what I'm talking about. And so I think that they have left this sort of open ground for these far-right parties to come in, and a lot of the voters I talked to when I was reporting in France, following around the people who voted for Le Pen, some of these were people who voted for the Communist Party in France 20 years ago. In Germany, it's people who are voting for the Social Democrats, in Holland for the Labour Party. So these are working-class, left-wing voters who find some appeal in this far-right agenda. And I think these politicians have played into it, and they've very intelligently latched onto that because they feel like they can say, I speak for you because no one else is listening to you.
I hear that argument. It just sounds, I think you'd appreciate my point, it just sounds eerily familiar to what's happening in our country right now. That a bunch of angry white males believe they have some legitimate grievances and they want to blame the other for whatever reasons, and they're turning more nativist. And I just don't see that. I mean, are there issues that we ought to address? I agree with you. Yes, there are issues that ought to be addressed. But the issues that ought to be addressed are not issues that ought to be addressed because someone else took your job, because someone else denied you an opportunity, because someone else is to blame. That's the part that I don't like. And so I don't consider those legitimate grievances that need to be debated.
No, I'm with you there. But what I'm saying is that when a political program leaves behind the economic agenda that could unite people of all ethnicities and all colors and all classes, it allows these other parties to move in and for politicians like Le Pen or like Trump to play upon those fears. And I think that if there was a broader debate, people say, you know, it's not the immigrants taking your job that's the problem. It's not the black folks moving in down the street that's your problem. That's a scapegoat. These people, but the politicians are leading that charge. They are creating these scapegoats. And because fear is such a powerful force in mobilizing political participation in this country or anywhere, people are latching onto that agenda. And it's not a viable message, but it will get you some votes. And that's what we've found in all of these places.
The book is called Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. Sasha, good to have you on the program. Thanks for the text, my friend.
Yeah, good thanks very much.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Revelations about Harvey Weinstein have led to a national conversation about sexual harassment and assault in the workplace. Gretchen Carlson has spoken out about the issue for some time now. In 2016, she sued the late Fox News Channel chairman and CEO Roger Ailes for sexual harassment. She's now sharing her experiences and insights in a new book called Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back. Good to have you on the program. This is the first time in all the years I've known you, I've been on your shows over the years.
Right.
First time having you on our set.
Well, reciprocal, right?
Yeah, yeah, finally.
Thank you so much for having me.
No,
I really
honored,
appreciate
honored
it.
To have you on. I think a lot of people were just shocked to see that $32 million figure that Mr. O'Reilly apparently, allegedly, according to the New York Times, paid to another Fox analyst. You were an anchor, of course, but another Fox analyst. When you saw that figure, when you saw that story, how did it hit you?
Well, I was horrified that any company would re-sign an employee after that kind of a money settlement, an employee who had been dismissed for those kinds of allegations. I was outraged even more to the same extent that that same person was invited back if those revelations were known. I mean, it's outrageous the lengths at which companies will go to protect harassers and shut up the victims. And it's not just happening in television and Hollywood. What I found out in researching my book is that it's happening everywhere across this country. Sexual harassment is an epidemic for women in all different financial categories and all different professions.
Yeah. I think the part of the story that struck me most, and I've been dying to ask you this, which is what you make of the fact that the network, apparently, according to the New York Times, accepted his retort and that of his attorney that this is a personal matter and that we will handle this. So here are two employees of your network. One is accused of having harassed the other, and you accept from his attorney, this is a private matter, it's a personal matter, we will handle this. And once they get that out of the way, then they go back to the network and say, okay, it's handled. They don't tell the network what the dollar figure was that we now know was $32 million that they settled for, but it's been handled, we've got this, now we can begin negotiations on Mr. O'Reilly's new contract. What did you make of the fact that the company allowed them to handle this as a private matter?
Like nothing ever happened. and that women should just be shut up and never heard from ever again.
And that didn't happen in their workplace.
And look at Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
You know, the board there allegedly knew that he was also doing these kinds of activities, and within his new contract, they said, well, we'll basically go ahead and continue to sexually harass women, but if we find out about it, you'll just have to pay us a fine. I mean, what does that say about companies' respect for women in the workplace? It says they don't care at all. And what remains outrageous to me in 2017 is that we're still having this discussion about an epidemic that hasn't been fixed. I mean, we fooled ourselves in our culture, Tavis, over the last couple of decades in thinking that we had resolved this issue. But one of the main reasons why we think that is because so many sexual harassment cases are settled in silence. When you sign a settlement, you're gagged.
It's the NDA, better known as we call it NDA, non-disclosure agreement. Okay.
And also, the other way in which we solve these issues is that prevalent in employee contracts is a clause called forced arbitration. So you basically give up your Seventh Amendment right to any kind of dispute that you might have at work. Trust me, I never expected to have a dispute. People don't. But if you do, what you find out in one of your darkest days is that you are not going to an open jury process amongst your peers to have it adjudicated. You're going to a secret chamber called arbitration, and you can never tell anyone what happened to you. And in many cases, you are fired, and the harasser gets to stay on the job. So this is how we are fooling our culture into believing that we've come so far, because we never hear about these cases. But that's why.
So let me be gentle here, but you're a journalist, I know you can handle this. It is obviously legal. Put another way, it is a legal tool, talking now about the NDA. So that when Gretchen or anyone else signs an agreement, they're told when they sign this, here's the amount of money you're going to get, this is what you're going to say, here's what we're going to say, and beyond this, nobody's going to say anything else, and if you do, you're subject to yeah. So you sign this NDA. I understand, because I've been through enough of these contracts myself, I understand why you would sign it, and yet I'm ambivalent about it, because to your own point, it keeps everything quiet. It keeps it secret. I don't know how that aids and abets us getting a handle on the issue.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
The only other option people like me have is that they would have been forced into secret arbitration and you would never have heard about my case.
Right.
I mean, had it not been for the legal strategy to make my case public, and by the way, people can go online and read my complaint. So it's out there. But you're left with two choices, silence or silence. That's really where we are right now in the culture. So what accompanies all of this are a lot of myths with regard to this. You know, well, why didn't you come forward sooner? Well, that is a loaded question, because when you're going up against one of the most powerful people in the world, it's an excruciating choice, because how do we still label women? We label them liars, troublemakers, and worse. They're not to be believed. They just can't take a joke. So who dares to come forward? We had our own president who said that women come forward for money and fame. I've never met anybody who wanted to be famous for this issue. So there are so many myths that surround it. Here's where I feel so optimistic right now. Since I jumped off my own cliff 15 months ago, look where we are today. We're talking about these horrific headlines, but the positive is that more women are putting their names and their faces to this issue. They are digging deep to find the courage and the bravery to come forward. And to me, this is a tipping point in our society.
Is it courage and is it bravery, to use your words, when scores of women, many of them well known, start coming out to tell their stories after the fact? And what each of them says is that it would have, in one way, shape, or form, it would have damaged my career. Now, I'm sensitive to that. I'm sensitive to it, and I totally get that. And I don't tell people how to live their lives, how to make their own decisions, how to make their own judgments. But what I think I hear you saying is that you chose your career over being a whistleblower. And I'm just not sure that that is the definition of courage and bravery. I'm glad you came out and spoke. I'm glad you're on the record, because you need to know that, and people need to know the story, you know, however they discover it. But is it courage and is it bravery if you come out after the fact rather than making a choice that my principles, my life, my womanhood, my dignity is more important than my career, and I'm going to come out and say this anyway?
Well, I did do that.
Yeah, you did. You did. I'm not asking about you. I'm asking, since you raised Harvey Weinstein, I'm asking about whether or not you think it's courageous and brave of other women after the fact to then come out and...
I do.
Okay.
Because in my mind, I think that we shouldn't question the timing of when women finally find that courage. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, it's an excruciating choice. Courage building is not something that happens to you overnight, like a light switch that you just turn on.
Absolutely.
I mean, I read a whole chapter on parenting because I think it actually starts in the way in which we raise our kids, and much more specifically our sons, to respect women in the home so that when they get into the workforce, they respect their female colleagues. So I'm not going to judge women who don't find that courage overnight. I know how hard it is to build. And I had a great foundation as a child with parents who told me I could be anything I wanted to be. And I had a tremendous amount of courage as a kid and was tenacious and brave. But even with me making this most personal decision in my life, it was painful and took a tremendous amount of time. So that's why I'm not gonna judge any other women.
How did you process, Gretchen, past the, what I assume, at some point had to be bitterness, anger, disappointment. How'd you navigate through that part of this 12-step program that you had to go through?
In making the decision to come forward?
Yeah.
Well, just like you, I've worked so hard my whole life. I had 25 years in the TV business. And when I realized last July that that was gonna come to an end for me, at least at that particular place, and that it wasn't my choice, I had to dig incredibly deep to make the jump. And I had to do it not only for myself, really for all the other women out there that I eventually heard from that was the impetus for the book. I heard from thousands of women, and it was unbelievable to me that it started happening on the first day, from every profession. And here's what they said. Thank you so much for being the voice for the voiceless. And when I went back to them and said, could I share your stories in my book, I thought, about half will say no at least. Almost all said, would you please? Because nobody has ever cared about what happened to me. And that's when I felt the additional call of duty, that I had to write this book to give those women a voice and to stop this from happening for future generations. And I really feel in this book like we're celebrating men too. Whole chapter on men. My unscientific study on the streets of New York City, you know who I hear more from? Men than anyone else. When they pass me by, they stop, they shake my hand, and they say, thank you for my daughters. Men out there, the majority of men, want to help women in this mission. It's just these random jerks that we have to get rid of along the way.
And what's our assignment for all the men around the world, around this country?
Thank you.
What's our assignment?
Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
So to be part of the Be Fierce movement, stop being enablers, because that normalizes the culture. Speak up and stop being a bystander if you can also find the courage in your heart to stand up for a woman when you see somebody being wronged. And not just a woman, any other situation in the workplace. If we can do those two things and turn bystanders and enablers into allies, imagine the shift within the corporate culture. I mean, suddenly women would have a man as their ally, and a man can shut it down like that. You hear something, locker room talk, and you say, you know what? I don't approve of that. Don't ever speak like that before me ever again. It's the end of the story, especially when it comes from a man. So men are just as much a part of this movement as women. In fact, what I'd like to say is that the burden of finding a solution to this shouldn't only rest on the shoulders of women. We need men.
And you understand, I'm not demonizing anybody either. I'm just asking questions.
I totally get it. You're asking great questions.
Everybody, these are uncomfortable questions to ask, and yet the questions I've tried to raise are questions that I hear everywhere I go.
I know.
We're all having, to your point, these conversations, and it just takes a little different kind of energy to raise them. But anyway, her name, of course, is Gretchen Carlson. The book is called Be Fierce, Stop Harassment, and Take Your Power Back. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Higher education is often seen as a path to social mobility and economic opportunity, but more and more, students who start college end up increasing their debts and don't complete their degree courses. I'll explore why this is happening and what can be done about it as part of our ongoing education series with Douglas Haynes, Vice Provost of the University of California, Irvine, John King Jr., the former U.S. Education Secretary and the current President of the Education Trust, and Michelle Siqueiros, the President of the Campaign for College Opportunity.
Let me start with the obvious question, which is why there are so many students starting and not finishing, and particularly, Mr. King, students of color.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, you've got a couple things going on. One is economic challenges. So for many students, they are spending a very large share of their family's income on the cost of college, even with the aid that they're receiving from the federal government and often from their state government. We know low-income students can be spending as much as 3/4 of their family income on college tuition, whereas for affluent students, it's a much smaller portion. But once you get over the financial issues, there are lots of issues around what it's like to be on a college campus. For students who are maybe the first in their family to go to college, college can feel very unfamiliar. That first bad grade can lead them to feel defeated, or they may find that they don't have quite the academic preparation that they need. And so there's a lot that institutions of higher education can do to actually make college a more successful environment for students.
Why is that percentage of income gap so wide for poor versus wealthy families?
Well, one of the factors is that over the last few years, we've seen states really systematically disinvest in public higher education. And so families are bearing a larger share of the cost, and that has the biggest impact on folks from low-income communities. And we also have all of the complicated American history around race and class that results in families of color typically having much less in terms of family wealth than certainly white upper-middle-income students.
You want to add to that?
Yes, I mean the challenge keeps growing. Yeah. There's been a 20% decline in state support for public higher education since the recession. In California alone, it's 9%. And those costs too often are shifted to parents, low-income parents. And it does have a significant impact. But universities are learning how to improve success for students.
How are they doing that?
Well, first, they're looking at it as a long game instead of a short-term game. It begins with outreach early on, K through 12, demystifying the process of applying to college, visiting college to actually see what it's like as a physical space, and then equipping them to navigate the application process and financial aid. We do that through our Centers for Educational Partnerships. It's very important because a majority of our students are first generation. And so what we try to do at UC Irvine is to collectivize the social capital of the university so more individuals who are first generation or low income can not only apply and get admitted, but thrive while they're at UCI. And that's the key thing, to thrive while they're there, to provide the appropriate support that could be additional tutoring, but also thinking beyond college in terms of an ecosystem. So when they leave college, they're part of a network of people who are helping them build their careers.
Michelle, this seems so unfair that you have these first generation college students who still have to bear these kinds of burdens, financial and otherwise. It would seem, after all the practice we've had at this, we'd be better off than we are now, and that first generation students wouldn't have to carry this sort of weight.
I think that's what's disturbing, that we all know that higher education is really the pathway out of poverty and the value of going to college, especially amongst Black and Latino families across the country, is incredibly high. That's the dream that we all have for our own children. As somebody very sage once said, do what rich people do, and rich people send their kids to college. And so it is disturbing because that is the path to the American dream, and we've got to make sure that our states are investing. We also have to hold institutions accountable to do some of the things that UC Irvine and other campuses are doing to ensure that welcoming environment. We've got to make sure professors support students when they do get that first bad grade. I remember when I was in college, I got a C and a note from the professor, come see me, which I thought meant they were definitely kicking me out of campus. And thankfully, it wasn't that conversation. It was a conversation about what kind of support do you need? How can I help you with the readings? We need to do much more of that.
Well, at least you got a C. I'm gonna tell you what I got. But you can guess it was worse than a C when I got called in my second semester in school. I'm not naive in asking this question, Mr. King, but tell me why it is that the cost of education is going up so fast. What's driving the increase in education?
Yeah, it's a variety of factors. For some campuses, it's that their faculty have gotten older and they have liability that's been absorbed over many decades for pensions and healthcare benefits. For other campuses, it's that they've invested in facilities and facilities upgrades that are costly. But at the end of the day, the biggest challenge is that the support for students from the federal and state level hasn't kept pace. Mm-hmm. You think about Pell Grants, the primary mm-hmm. federal support for low-income students, it's at a 40-year low in terms of what portion of the cost of higher education it covers. We should be doing a better job supporting students.
Well, why is that? Because every president that runs, you work for one, Barack Obama, who said this, Trump said it in his own way. Every person who's ever run for president always says in their own way, I want to be the education president. Nobody's going to downgrade education while they're campaigning. So how is it that those numbers are going in the wrong direction?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there's been a reluctance to make the necessary investment. Now, over the course of the Obama administration, we added $1,000 to the maximum mm-hmm. Pell Award, indexed Pell to inflation, so at least it was keeping pace with inflation. But that's actually going to end this year. And a big question for Congress is, will they continue to invest? Hopefully increase the investment, or will they follow the lead of the current administration mm-hmm. and retreat from investment? They've actually proposed very significant cuts to higher education assistance for students.
What do you make of that? Why do you think our rhetoric is so disconnected? Our rhetoric about the value of education is so disconnected from our public policy?
I think it's accountability.
Yeah.
Just to give you an illustration, California, the University of California basically competes with prisons for discretionary funding.
Wow.
Right? It costs more to support an inmate than it does to educate a student in the University of California. And so whatever politicians say, their actions speak volumes. Because in some sense, that first generation Latino, that first generation African American that's going to college needs more support. And it's just a matter of time before institutions really have to face the existential decision. Can we afford a world-class education for students who are different, who are low-income students of color from low-income families?
How much of this is not about, how about I put this, not about equality, but about equity? And I know the three of you know the distinction that I'm drawing here. And I don't know that we can ever get to a real conversation about equity, meeting students where they are and giving them what they need, if we're constantly fighting about what school has this, what school doesn't have this. How do you get to the equity conversation?
Research first.
Yeah.
I think, and I want to go back to
the point. Is the research clear about that already, though?
Well, the research that I'm thinking about is universities understanding how they actually teach students. Mm-hmm. How do they actually support students? Because in the absence of that, you can have a commitment to equity, but you will have very inadequate delivery. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a push that I've noticed, certainly at UCI, but elsewhere, in trying to learn more about how students learn, to equip our teaching assistants and faculty to actually know how to manage new learners.
And we've got equity challenges at every level of the system. We've only got about 40% of four-year-olds in public preschool. So access to early learning is where mm-hmm. we start. In K-12, we know some students are getting much more than others. We know, for example, from the Civil Rights Data Collection survey, that there are schools, high schools, where you can't take physics or chemistry or algebra 2. What chance do you have to pursue a STEM career mm-hmm. if you can't even take those classes in high school? So we've got an equity challenge in K-12. And then in higher ed, we often have institutions with a mindset, you know, the kids are first generation, the students are low-income students, they're working. It's not really our fault. We do the best we can. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have institutions like UC Irvine, like a Georgia State, for example, that say, no, we're responsible for not just getting students to college, but through college with a meaningful degree. We're going to provide advising. We're going to provide tutoring. We're going to reach out to students and make sure they have the support they need. And that institutional behavior is critical.
I would just add that we need, you know, courageous leaders and the public to be courageous to talk about race and equity in the ways that make us feel uncomfortable, because folks don't want to talk about race. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that we all stand to benefit, whether it's in California, Texas, Florida, yeah. Illinois. If we are undereducating black and brown children, we are all going to pay the price for what that means. Mm.
Well said. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for your work. Good to have you on this program. Thanks. For more of this conversation, go to our website at pbs.org/Tavish to hear more of what these brilliant minds have to say about how we fix this crisis, specifically for students of color trying to get a high quality education. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Danai Gurria is an award-winning actress, playwright, and activist. Her plays include the critically acclaimed Broadway production Eclipsed, which starred Academy Award winner Lupita Nyong'o. On screen, she's best known for her role as Michonne on AMC's The Walking Dead, which has just started its 8th season. And she'll appear in the upcoming Marvel film Black Panther. Before we start our conversation, here now a clip from The Walking Dead.
I know you wanted to go with him. I did too.
Everything hurts.
But I'll help you defend this place.
Help me?
Oh, yeah. This is your show. Okay. We'll see.
This is like the most popular show in the world.
I guess. Yeah. I'll go with what you're saying. That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. You sort of hear that sort of thing and you're sort of floored by it, but that's amazing.
Yeah, but a chance to be in a show that is celebrated and seen, not just in this country, but as celebrated and as seen around the world is a big deal.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I consistently pinch myself because I stepped into it really from a place of wanting to be a part of something that felt like really rigorous, intense, truthful human storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I write as well. So for me, it was that question of signing, you know, you sign that contract that could be a 7-year thing. You want to make sure it's something that feels right to you. And that's very important to me.
Yeah.
And it just felt so right when I watched from the pilot up until at that point, season 2. It was just the right elements were in place for you to feel really fulfilled as an artist.
And what were those elements for you as an artist?
Well, what was interesting was there was a lot of overlap with who I was as a playwright. Mm-hmm. One of my plays, Eclipsed, mm-hmm. deals with women at war and how they have to respond to a world that completely works out of their favor, in fact, is insanely hostile towards them, mm-hmm. and how they navigate survival. And that felt like so many elements of what was going on in The Walking Dead, like how you navigate survival in a world that's turned against you. And really my character, who I found really fascinating actually, I was like, who is this woman who has a katana and dreadlocks? And like, mm-hmm. I was like, I've never seen this before.
Yeah.
And you know, I was so intrigued by her. But she also reminded me of the women I researched, the women I interviewed in Liberia who had turned into their own weapons of war to combat a war zone that was working against them but was not of their making.
Yeah.
So there were so many overlaps I found that really connected to what I find important, which is that storytelling of who would you be if the world got this dire?
Yeah.
And really, both the premise of Eclipse and the premise of The Walking Dead were like overlappingly identical in that way.
I'm going to come back because you're very modest. You're not just a playwright. Your stuff has been Tony nominated. So we'll come back to that in just a second. Back to your stage work. But since you've made this parallel, Danai, we'll come to your play and the humanity in that. For you though, where was the humanity play in your role on The Walking Dead? What did you see? What did you discover that?
Well, I mean, the beauty of her was really that, you know, she comes onto the scene and she brings a whole new element to the storytelling. Mm-hmm. We meet Rick and we meet his family and his friends and the people he ends up connecting with. We meet them right at the beginning of this basically end of civilization moment.
Right.
And so we see them take their initial steps into how are they going to navigate this new world. And with her, we meet her after navigation has been happening for a while. So we meet her in her kind of her post-PTSD. Well, she's really in PTSD, mm-hmm. but we're seeing her navigate her PTSD in a way that involves having shut down emotionally, having decided to become her own weapon of war, having, you know, really figured out her own way through without connecting with other people. She's really cut herself off from humanity to protect herself from further loss. So she was just a totally different segment of the experience coming in to people we've been getting to know since the moment things went awry. Yeah. So I found that really, really fascinating, and it allowed for such a stunning journey for her to take as a character, where she kind of has to start reconnecting to her humanity and facing those fears and the trauma of her past and choosing to navigate into a new future and to fight for one.
Yeah.
And so really piecing those things together and knowing that, you know, she was going to have to go through that journey as a character, but she was going to start off very stoic, very disconnected from being able to communicate or to, share her traumas or to connect with other people again, you know, and really being kind of, she was disarming to so many people because you couldn't read her, and she wanted it that way. And I found her, she was kind of that person you're like, I don't know if I should mess with this person or talk to this person. It was very interesting to play that because I'm very gregarious and loquacious, and she's not. She wasn't in the beginning, and that was very interesting to navigate.
Let me go back to your playwright work, because we were celebrating you from a distance. Of course, this is in New York, the Tonys. We're out here in L.A., but we were celebrating you when those announcements were made. That had to be stunning for you.
It was amazing. It was very another pinch me, I'm dreaming moment. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that play's journey was so epic. That was my second play. I was on to my fourth at that point. But it had started off I'd created it in 2009, 2008. And it had a really great life in regional theaters. Mm-hmm. And one of the regional theaters we had an original production in was Yale Repertory, where Lupita was understudying, because their MFA students understudy the characters that go into the repertory. Mm-hmm. So that's how we connected. And I knew her from before, but we connected much more during that process. And I kept trying to use her for my plays, but she was in school. Mm-hmm. So I had my next play, The Convert, and I was like, this is also perfect for you, like, come and how do we strategize to get you out of school to come and do these productions? And I understand it, and as an African myself, you don't step out of school to do, you finish, you get that degree. I knew she was going, we had to see her through to getting the degree, but there are many a time I wanted to pull her out and use her for the work. So she loved the play, and she had a deep connection to it, and it was great because I female director, all female cast, we just kind of all became very close sisters. And she told me after everything happened, when she graduated, everything happened with 12 Years a Slave so fast, but she told me, I really want to go back to the stage with Eclipsed. I want to go back to the stage. And that's kind of how that run of Eclipsed came to pass. And so, of course, I told them, the producers started to come at me, and I said, not without director Liesl Tommy. She's the director I trust with the work with this particular play. And so she was, of course, she came along, and we got on the ensemble together, and it was amazing because the play had done a lot of regional, but it had never come to New York. Yeah. It was almost like it was, the time had come for it to make it to New York.
And all those sisters, though, on the stage is a beautiful thing to see.
Mean, when I went into learning about what was happening with women in war, specifically in Liberia, a dear teacher gave me Ken Washington, who's now passed, was an amazing man, African-American man, who came to teach at Tisch often, and handed me a newspaper, New York Times. He said, I know you're into these type of stories. And I took it, and I was like, yes, I am. And it was basically the cover of the New York Times at that time was these women who were rebel fighters in Liberia. And I grew up on the continent. You can never call Africa monolithic, because I grew up in the most different part of the continent. When I looked at that, I said, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I grew up there, like seeing these women who were literally soldiers of war, but rebel soldiers, and decked out, and then they had their AK-47s. And I was like, what is this? Like, my mind was blown. And I knew I had to pursue that story at some point. It actually was 4 years later, after my first play, that I did. And so going to Liberia and meeting those women and, taking on that story, asking their permission if I could tell it in some ways, and sharing with them, this is what I would like to do. But that to me was, it became so clear that we don't hear their stories. Everyone knew who Charles Taylor was. Everyone knows the name of the big bad guy, and all the those key players who go to the treaties. Mm-hmm. But no one knows the names of the women and the girls who are the casualties of war, whose bodies are used, to fight wars upon. No one ever talks to them about them. And many of those women said to me, no one's ever asked me what happened to me during this time period. And that just became clearer and clearer to me that I was going to remove the male from the stage mm-hmm. and allow them to be seen and heard, because the title is about that. It's about their light being blocked. But the hope in the title is that an eclipse is always temporary.
Yeah. I got 2 minutes to go. I want to cover two topics if I can very quickly, a minute apiece. First, tell me about your work with these girls, Love Our Girls.
Oh, that is, it's something I created because I am very passionate yeah. about women and girls and the issues around the world concerning women and girls. And I was born on Valentine's Day. My name means to be in love, and Shauna. And, you know, I really, really wanted to bring about something around Valentine's Day. I always thought Valentine's Day was the most bizarre holiday. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, love needs to go. Everyone's like waiting for their thing. What yeah. should get me for Valentine's Day? What's it going to be? What's going to be? Rather than yeah. like, let's let it be love that's going outward. And yeah. The girls around the world need our love and attention. So every month I highlight an organization. I release a newsletter. It's an encouragement to take a pledge and connect to becoming yeah. aware and spreading awareness. Really, yeah. it's an awareness hub around women and girls.
And lastly, not that you can say much, Chadwick was just here not too long ago.
Yes.
So I can't let you go in the last 45 seconds without just saying two words, Black Panther.
Yeah. Listen, the most beautiful thing, I mean, it's so many beautiful things about being a part of that.
Yeah.
One of them is I grew up as a little girl on the continent. You grew up as a black boy in the United States. We didn't see this. Mm-hmm. We didn't see black people on that platform being superheroes, taking care of things, you know, having, you know, that sort of resonance. And to see, to be a part of that, to see it, mm-hmm. it's something that I would just have loved to watch it. The fact that I also get to be a part of it, yeah. it's amazing to me.
It's stunning, and I'm glad you're in it. Well, you're doing great work all across the board, so thank you for taking the time to come see us. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.